Track 12, and we come to our feature article. And this week, Soundings contributor Colin takes us on a trip through the ages to unwrap some of the myths and facts about the festive season. This item runs for about 14 minutes.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, I'm Colin. Now, we may think that we know the story of Christmas inside out, but do we? Really? It's time to unwrap the myths and true origins of Christmas. So, here we go. Before December the 25th was fully recognised as Christmas Day, it was already a significant date for another form of worship, the most widely practised religion in the Roman Empire. Its name? Mithraism, after the god Mithras, who reputedly sacrificed a sacred bull in a spring fertility ceremony. The birth of Mithras was also marked at the winter solstice, when he's said to have emerged from his birthplace in a cave, witnessed by two shepherds. More than that, we can't really say. The earliest evidence we have for a celebration of Christ's birth is when Julius I, Bishop of Rome from 337 to 352, decreed that Christ's nativity was to be observed on December the 25th. But it wasn't until the year 380 that Christianity became an established religion in Rome. Christmas, and some of the stories surrounding it, probably owes its key date to a merging of Christian and pagan traditions. According to biblical scholars' calculations, based on the Gospels and other church writings, April the 17th, May the 29th, and September the 15th are all more likely dates for the birth of Jesus. Now, interestingly, the question has often been asked, if Mary gave birth in December, why were the sheep still in the fields in the winter months, when they should have been taken into the villages for warmth? Answers on a postcard, please, but not to me. That said, the choice of December the 25th seems instead to have been tied to the winter solstice, the shortest day of the year, which, when you think about it, makes more sense. The Venerable Bede, who seems to have had an opinion about everything, claimed in about 730 that ancient Britons referred to December and January as Yule, probably derived from a Norse word, Jule, which originally meant festivities. Quite how he knew this is anybody's guess, but then he wasn't called Venerable for nothing, was he? It wasn't until sometime after the 9th century that the word Christmas, or rather Christ's Mass, replaced Yule in the British Isles. The use of Christmas gradually became standard, and Yule only returned in the 19th century with the rekindling of love for ancient traditions. By the 11th century, in France, a star was hung over church altars for an Epiphany play that was incorporated into the Mass. And the story of the Magi, of Herod and the massacre of the innocents was acted out. Soon after, in the 12th century, English churches also staged these plays. Another form of theatre originated with Francis of Assisi, who, in 1223, produced a replica stable with a manger and real animals, an ox and an ass, setting the scene for the model animals which came along much later. Moving on to the 13th century, and the reign of King John, courtly Christmas feasts became mind-bogglingly elaborate. On Christmas Day 1213, the king's household and guest consumed, wait for it, 27 hogshead of wine, 400 head of pork, 3,000 fowl, 15,000 herring, 10,000 eels, 100 pounds of almonds, 2 pounds of spices, and 66 pounds of pepper. Well, I bet they wished they'd had Gaviscon in those days. Thankfully, Edward III later tried to curb excess, passing laws restricting the meals on 7 of the holiday's 12 days to just 2 courses, with a limit of 2 kinds of meat per course. Very sensible. A quick jump to the 16th century now, where an historian claimed that in previous centuries, every parish had a great pole serving as a maypole in summer, decorated with holly and ivy in the winter. Well, don't get too excited. This wasn't a Christmas tree as we know it today, but it might be considered a precursor. An association between trees and Christmas was emerging, especially in Germany, and by 1531, there was a new fashion with Strasbourg markets selling trees for people to erect indoors, although these were apparently not yet decorated. The first decorated indoor tree we know of appeared in 1605, again in Strasbourg. Adorned with paper roses, apples, wafers, gilded sweets, and sugar ornaments, it was what, a few years later, would be given a new name, a Christmas tree. Just to add a downer at this point, in Scotland in 1561, the newly reformed Kirk declared all of Christmas a nasty popish invention and banned the holidays entirely. By the turn of the century in Scotland, carol singing, playing football, making music and dancing were all banned as being profane activities. Joining in the fun and not wanting to be left out, a growing number of ardent English Protestants also began to condemn the secular holiday. The English Civil War was particularly unkind to Christmas. Oliver Cromwell and his mates saw Christmas, of which there was no mention in the Bible, as a mark of the Antichrist. So, in 1643, Cromwell's Parliament sat on the 25th of December to make sure everyone understood that this was to be a working day like any other day. And by 1645 it was decreed that festival days, vulgarly called holy days, have no warrant in the word of God and are not to be continued. What a bunch of killjoys. Fortunately, the English ban didn't survive long after Cromwell's death. But apart from 1660 to 1690, the Scottish Kirk's ban continued until, and I'm not making this up, honest, 1958. Yes, 1958. When Christmas became an official holiday in Scotland for the first time in a quarter of a millennium. Towards the end of the 17th century, Christmas quickly regained its popularity, although many continue to fear that the holiday seduced the population to, and I quote, drunkenness, gluttony, and unlawful gaming, wantonness, uncleanness, lasciviousness, cursing, swearing, and ultimately idleness. The playwright William Davenant, sometimes said to have been Shakespeare's godson, had a character claim in one of his plays that more children were begot in the Christmas holidays than at any other time of the year. When the spirit of mince pies reigns in the blood. Strong stuff, eh? Not everyone felt the same. One 1675 carol booklet looked forward to Christmas. So we'll all be higgly-piggly one with another. Whatever that means. In 1767, a group of London bakers placed advertisements stating they wouldn't be giving traditional tips to their customers' servants on the grounds that if the lower ranks wallow in wealth during the holy days, they will spend it all on alcohol. That just sounds like an excuse to save money to me. To celebrate Christmas, said one newspaper, was to celebrate rioting and drunkenness. To be fair, this wasn't probably far from reality. Joseph Banks, the naturalist on Captain Cook's first voyage, recorded that the Endeavour's crew kept Christmas in the old-fashioned way. All hands were drunk as our forefathers used to be on the like occasion. The poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge visited Germany in 1798, and in 1809 wrote an essay describing the local Christmas tradition of decorating homes with boughs from trees. It was reprinted in the Times, and 14 years later, a tabletop tree appeared in an engraving of Queen Victoria and Albert, celebrating Christmas at Windsor Castle. That single image cemented the Christmas tree in the popular British consciousness, so much so that by 1861, the year of Albert's death, it was firmly believed that this German prince had transplanted the custom to England with him when he married. But it's in the works of Charles Dickens that Christmas first meets the modern world. His 1843 novel, A Christmas Carol, provided a new way of thinking about the holiday. No longer did it have to be the Christmas of oldie England, where the squire was in his manor house and all was right with the world. Now it could be a Christmas where working people travelled home by public transport from counting houses and offices, where charity was the remit of the rising middle classes, not of the gentry taking care of their own tenants. Following Dickens' lead, Christmas pursuits such as cooking the turkey, playing games, drinking toasts, or buying toys for your children became part of the new middle-class domesticity, leaving the religious aspect partially out on a limb. Talking of limbs, the branches of Christmas trees lit by candles represented a frightening fire risk. A lit tree was never a safe tree, and many households lit their candles only once on Christmas Eve, prudently keeping to hand water and a stick with a sponge on the end. It was America that produced the first commercial string of electric lights. In 1891, a tree with lights, powered by electricity, was put up in the children's ward of a New York hospital. Later, a department store brochure assured customers that the lamps are all lighted at once by the turning of a switch, will burn as long as desired without attention, and can be readily extinguished. A much safer option. It was America, too, that produced the image most of us have of Father Christmas, or Santa Claus, when Coca-Cola ran an advertising campaign from 1931 to 1964, and again in the 1980s and 90s and beyond. Although his red coat first appeared in the 1830s, it was the Coke ads that spread the quintessential Santa across the globe. A white-bearded man wearing a red jacket trimmed with white fur, belted across a substantial midriff, red trousers and black boots, and, frequently, a red pointed cap with white fur trim. Rudolph, too, was a commercial invention. The red-nosed reindeer appeared in 1939, courtesy of a department store copywriter named Robert May. By the 21st century, Christmas was, and still is, being celebrated by many who shared none of its traditions, who weren't or aren't even nominally Christians. Magazines, books, film and television have transmitted the formula to places where the meaning of the symbols matter little. Christmas has assimilated traditions from half a dozen cultures and countries, and it's these contrasts and these changes that make Christmas what it is today, a holiday that shape-shifts itself to become what we, what our cultures, need it to be at any given time. Christmas has transformed itself over the centuries, from a time for the nobility to display their wealth to their dependents, for adults to enjoy what little extra they could gather, to a festival primarily for and about children. From the elite to the masses, from adult to child, from public to family. While the holiday has altered, it's survived. It's thrived. Because, ultimately, Christmas is not what it is, or even what it has been. but what we hope for. Merry Christmas.
TNF Soundings.